You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 26th of July 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House here on Monocle 24, live from Studio One here in London with me, Emma Nelson and Chloe Potter.
Over the last 12 months, the people of Mali have suffered a coup, an uprising in the north and foreign intervention. Can the West African nation's last-minute elections return the country to unity and stability?
Also ahead is the construction of new government buildings is banned in China. We ask if an important architectural tradition is being lost for the sake of cost-cutting.
You can see everywhere in China, every single street is huge and the city blocks are huge. Therefore, buildings are huge, and which in a way kind of encourage people or governments to build something big.
Plus, in a preview of this week's culture, we visit the Durban International Film Festival, which was this year dominated by a debate about censorship and freedom of expression.
The people behind the response are showing ignorance, lack of understanding of that which they regulate, and just downright incompetence.
All that, plus we set the day's agenda with our Tokyo Bureau Chief, we review the news from Copenhagen, and we'll play you some great music too. That's all to come in the next hour here on Midori House. But first, let's catch up on the latest world news with James Luckhurst.
Monocle 24 News. At least 38 people have been killed when a coach plunged more than 15 metres off a motorway viaduct in southern Italy. Officials say 11 people were pulled out alive from the coach and taken to hospital, some with serious injuries. Rescue operations are continuing. The coach was carrying people back to Naples after visiting Telese Terme in the southern region of Campania. A spokesman for the fire service described the situation as dramatic, adding that several other vehicles were also involved in the collision. A series of car bomb attacks in the Iraqi capital Baghdad has killed 44 people today. More than 100 people were injured by the blasts in mostly Shia areas of the city, according to police and hospital sources. A requiem mass is due to take place in the Spanish city of Santiago de Compostela, where a train crash last Wednesday claimed 79 lives. The Spanish Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy, who comes from the city, and members of the Spanish royal family are expected to attend. The driver of the train, Francisco José Garzón, could face 79 counts of reckless homicide. He was released from custody by a judge on Sunday. The European Union's foreign policy chief, Catherine Ashton, is to hold crisis talks in Cairo today after the weekend killing of at least 72 supporters of Egypt's deposed Islamist president plunged the country deeper into turmoil. Several thousand supporters of ousted President Mohamed Morsi's Muslim Brotherhood have threatened to march on the military's intelligence headquarters in defiance of a warning from the army to stay away. The Egyptian Foreign Minister Nabil Fahmy says the Muslim Brotherhood should be part of Egypt's political future and must stop inciting violence. He said there was still room for the Brotherhood to be part of the political process.
The problems that emerged against the former president, President Morsi, from a very large percentage of the public was because he wanted to move forward without non-Brotherhood members. So it was the exclusion of others that led this momentum to the huge demonstrations that occurred before the 30th of June. So I would recommend that as we move forward, we do not exclude anyone who is ready to work according to the Constitution in a peaceful fashion. Even if I personally reject their positions or ideology, they have to find their place in Egypt's political lives.
The US State Department has announced that Israeli and Palestinian negotiators will resume peace talks in Washington on Monday. The talks, which have stalled since 2010, follow months of shuttle diplomacy by US Secretary of State John Kerry. Cambodia's main opposition party has rejected election results given by the government, which said long-term serving Prime Minister Hun Sen's party had won. The Cambodian National Rescue Party has called for an inquiry into what it called massive manipulation of electoral rolls. Its leader is Sam Rainsy.
We ask them now to send experts to be part of this technical joint technical committee in order to investigate all the irregularities and to assess the implications of all the irregularities on election results. What we are interested in is to render justice to the Cambodian people, to ensure that the will of the Cambodian people will not be distorted or reversed as before.
Zimbabwe's veteran president Robert Mugabe has spoken at his last campaign rally before the presidential election on Wednesday. He stressed again his promise to make sure the country's economy was controlled by the Zimbabwean people themselves. Mr. Mugabe, who's 89, has led the Zimbabwe African National Union Patriotic Front, ZANU-PF party, since independence in 1980. The rally took place in the National Stadium of Zimbabwe, attracting tens of thousands of people who gathered to show their support for Mr. Mugabe. Supporters spoke after the event.
He's a fighter. He's a true leader. He has been leading us for the past 33 years.
President Mugabe does not promise, but he demonstrates how things are done. We have heard what we have seen, all those problems which we have seen, which were actually thrown into the nation by those who do not want us to believe in our leader.
And those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
Thanks very much, James. It's 6 minutes past the hour here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Welcome to Midori House, live from Studio One in London. Time now to set the day's agenda with the three big stories from one part of the world that you need to know about. Today we're joined by Fiona Wilson, Monocle's Tokyo Bureau Chief. Welcome to the show, Fiona.
Thanks. Good morning.
Good morning. We start with the Cambodian elections, the results being rejected by the opposition there.
Yes, yeah, somewhat predictably, I suppose. There'd been a lot of controversy in the run-up to this election. Human Rights Watch saying there was a sort of an atmosphere of intimidation for voters and that there was too much partisan campaigning by the military and the police. And Sam Rainsy, who heads up the opposition party, has said that they're not going to accept the result, which they did lose. In fact, the Hun Sen, who's been in power since 1985, didn't do as well as he might have expected. He got 68 seats out of 123. But he still won. But the opposition is saying there were just too many irregularities.
The fact is, though, that Hun Sen didn't even do any campaigning. He sent relatives and supporters to campaign for him. He said quite jokingly that he wouldn't leave even if he was turfed out. Plus the fact that there have always been allegations of widespread vote rigging. Is Sam Rainsy and his supporters just basically making noises that will never be listened to?
Yeah, that may be the case. I mean, Hun Sen did say recently he fancied another 10 years in power, which is really not very encouraging. I mean, Sam Rainsy he's been in exile for a while. He was convicted in absentia to 11 years in prison in 2010. He got a royal pardon earlier this month. He came back just in time for the election, although not in time to stand. And, you know, I think that a lot of people rallied around him. There were thousands of people who turned out for him. It is difficult. Hun Sen does pretty much control the media. Clearly, the police and the military are behind him. He has all the resources at his fingertips. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he also has a certain amount of support in the countryside. They've seen a lot of change, some of it good, some of it not so good. And a huge investment from China, which is seen very... there's a lot of ambivalence about China's involvement. There are a lot of projects which have involved people being thrown off their land, which are very unpopular. And there's a suggestion that Hun Sen is too much in China's pocket.
That's the thing, though, Fiona, isn't it? Hun Sen has presided over Cambodia becoming one of the fastest growing economies. And that's the thing that matters, especially to the young voters.
Yes, but I think, you know, a lot of people are saying at what price. It's not very fairly spread. The benefits of that economic growth are still very much concentrated in the hands of a few. So, yes, there's been economic growth, but it's where that money is going to that people are questioning.
Let's move on to the final round of talks between North and South Korea about the Kaesong Industrial Complex plant. It was closed in, it was closed, but workers were withdrawn from the plant in April when North Korea was flexing its muscles. It's an incredibly important economic project for both North and South Korea. Do you think these talks to try and get it reopened will go anywhere?
Yeah, I mean, they've had six rounds of talks now. You are starting to wonder when they say the final. These are the final offer. You wonder if it's really going to happen. I mean, you're right, it's worth a lot of money. It was $420 million in goods last year. And it's worth a lot to North Korea, which really needs that kind of currency. It was paying well over $80 million in salaries to these 53,000 North Korean workers. They weren't pocketing it, of course, but you know, it makes a big difference. And it was the only point of contact, really, between the North and the South. It was a gesture of goodwill. And the fact that it's closed just shows how badly things have gone since then.
As you say, Fiona, it's not just about the economics, is it? It's highly symbolic, a way of fostering relationships.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great, great challenge for President Park. You know, what is she going to do with the situation? North Korea just continues to be this maverick power, which has a logic and a rationale of its own. It's managed to maintain its position quite unbelievably, given its economic situation, but through a sort of combination of threats, the occasional nuclear test and a missile firing, it's managed to really hold such a sway over East Asia. It has a huge influence over policy. You know, it upsets the Japanese, obviously upsets China, who really can't control what they do. And clearly for South Korea, you know, sharing a border, it's a huge problem.
Fiona, let's move on to another area of political instability or tension, but this time played out on the football pitch.
I know, well, who'd have thought football could be so controversial? Yeah, the East Asia Cup final yesterday in Seoul, Japan, South Korea playing, you might have thought there'd be some incident. And true to form, there was. A massive banner was unfurled by some South Korean supporters saying that no country that forgets its past has a future, clearly referencing Japan and its the way it presents its wartime past and its colonial past with South Korea, which is still a huge problem. And, you know, even in the aftermath of that incident, the Japanese and the South Koreans can't agree about that either. The South Koreans say, we're not investigating it. The Japanese are saying, oh, we will be investigating it. So what exactly will happen isn't clear, but FIFA is clear that political banners are not allowed. So it definitely broke a few rules there.
Yes, it should be unifying people, as football has a tendency to, shouldn't it? Fiona Wilson in our Tokyo Bureau, many thanks as always.
If design is your beat, then tune into Section D, our weekly show delving deep into the latest developments in the worlds of architecture, fashion, furniture, product development, tech and many more.
When Valentino touches the clothes, you see his hands tracing those lines of shape, form, and to see Valentino arranging one of his dresses is to understand the dress in terms of structure.
No matter what the sphere, we'll be here with expert insights, news and exclusive interviews on all things design. So switch on to Section D every Tuesday at 1900 hours London time.
The ancient practice of agriculture meets modern metropolis as we explore groundbreaking urban farms in Tokyo, Brooklyn and Oslo. Monocle Films visits the people bringing green growth to their thriving cities.
Everywhere you look, something is growing. There's Japanese pumpkin and bitter melon dangling from trellises, and eggplant sprouting in the lobby. Tomatoes hang from a conference room ceiling, and papaya and passion fruit trees double as partitions for meeting areas.
Seeds in the City, in the Films menu on monocle.com.
This weekend, Mali held its first election since a huge international effort drove out Islamist extremists from the north of the country earlier this year. The run-up to the polls didn't go so well, with four election officials kidnapped, voters threatened, and a sense that the country was not quite ready to return to the steady democracy it was once celebrated for being.
But by all accounts, the turnout was high to choose a new president out of the 26 men and one woman candidate. But will Mali find stability once again? Well, in a moment, we'll talk to Alex Duval-Smith, our woman in Mali, who'll be joining us in the line. But first, let's welcome James Schneider, editor of Think Africa Press, who joins us in the studio. Welcome back to the programme, James. This huge turnout took everybody by surprise, didn't it?
It's not. I mean, the figure, I don't think, has come out yet. It's huge relative to last time. It's not actually that large report. that it's sort of over 50% in areas of Bamako, somewhere between 55 and 65%, which in the context of previous elections in Mali is really good. Last election was about 40%. Turnout in Bamako was about 25%. But it's not huge. And also in the context where Mali's got a population of almost 16 million and less than 7 million voters are registered, and lots of Malians have been unable to vote. You have to view the kind of the turnout in context, but it's definitely a positive. There's been more engagement with the election than in previous elections, so it's good, but it's not huge, dramatic, amazing.
Mm. And despite those issues around the process and the concerns about lack of representation, particularly in the north, where hundreds of thousands of people have been displaced and unable to vote, it is being perceived as a positive thing in the country. It does seem that the international community's argument that it's a positive thing, even if it is rushed, even if there are these procedural problems, is gaining some momentum on the ground there.
Yes, I think that's true. I mean, the main problem with the rush to election, other than the procedural difficulties and the organisational difficulties and so on, and it looks like actually those have been managed reasonably well, as in there have been lots of problems, but if you look at the reports from polling centres, the reports of things being a bit wrong, there are quite a few of those, but sort of things being catastrophically wrong, there's not too much, which is pretty positive. But if you look at who the candidates are, and if as you said in your intro, Mali was viewed as a model democracy, but really wasn't a model democracy, which is how things could fall apart so quickly with the coup and the fall of the North. And when the main candidates are basically the main candidates who were going to stand in the last election, who are big political figures in Mali, and it's all part of the same political class, the idea that the elections are going to necessarily equal democracy and necessarily going to equal the will of the people, necessarily going to equal the kind of change that Mali wants and needs, I don't think that's quite clear.
Alex Duval-Smith in Bamako. James has just listed a catalogue of issues that the people of Mali had to get round. From your position, do you get any impression that this election could even be considered a success?
Well, I think it's a success in terms of the fact that Malians have sort of, by turning out in decent numbers in parts of the country where it was possible to do so and safe to do so, they've essentially voted in favour of voting. They've voted in favour of democracy. They've voted in favour of picking up the situation and regaining Mali's honour and pride in itself. So that's positive. But, I mean, it's very, very true, and we indications are coming through now of who might be the outright winner, that this doesn't really necessarily lay the table for a model democracy. If ever there was one in Mali, it just shows that people were terribly shocked by the past. They really almost saw their country disappear, and they had to call on the former colonial power to save it. And this is what you get. You get a strong reaction.
And Alex, do we have a sense of a front runner?
Well, we do. The state broadcaster, ORTM, last night actually already announced that Ibrahim Boubacar Keita, the former prime minister, who's failed twice before to be elected, he's been a candidate, is very much in the lead and might win in a single round, which will also be very unusual in Mali. It's only happened once before. Ibrahim Boubacar Keita is a strong man. Ibrahim Boubacar Keita fought a campaign around the idea of winning back Mali's honour, the idea of a strong army, safe borders, and he was the choice of several prominent religious leaders who did not shy away from calling on their followers to vote for him. A lot of his supporters were putting out the message that you'd better vote for IBK, that's his nickname, you better vote for IBK or things might go wrong. And the reason they could put that message across was that essentially he is also the army's favoured candidate, the coup leaders, last year's coup leaders' favoured candidate.
Exactly as Alex was saying, IBK is a vote for a return to a previous stability rather than a vote for something more hopeful. It seems quite a defensive vote in that he was prime minister for much of the 90s. He was from the former ruling party and then he split and he formed his own party. Of the three front runners, he's the one that has been least harassed, or not really harassed at all, by the coup leaders. So he is probably best placed to deal with them, make sure that nothing goes too awry, deal with Captain Sonogo, who is the leader of the coup. And as Alex was saying, he's gone to Kidal in the far north and he's campaigned there looking for signs of unity. But fundamentally, he's a no change from 18 months ago candidate.
When we were looking at the run-up to the elections, there was this big difference between what was happening in the north of the country and what was happening in Bamako. Mm. Will IDK go to any degree to try and bring these two problems together?
And I think, yeah, and anybody who wins the election is going to have to, and they are going to be forced to as well by international donors and in particular by France, which is pretty much managing the situation in Kidal. But yes, it's rather different there. The Tuareg separatists have been sort of allowed back in and given a degree of prominence by the French. And there were threats today, threats yesterday, don't go and vote. And so turnout there was pretty low, but it's interesting that the support for the separatists there does not seem universal.
Jamie Schneider, editor of Think Africa Press, thank you very much indeed for joining us. And our thanks to Alex Duval-Smith on the line from Bamako. You're listening to Midori House.
Now, they are the palaces of power of a nation on the rise. Cutting-edge design, extravagant interiors. No expense has been spared, it seems, for the city halls, department office blocks and other organs of government in China. But it seems the good times for China's lavish government buildings are over. Banquets for visiting dignitaries have already been outlawed. Red carpet receptions for government officials have also been prohibited. And now a five-year ban on the construction of new government buildings has also come into force.
On this week's edition of the Monocle Weekly, Monocle's Andrew Tuck and Sophie Grove spoke to Charles Fu, co-founder of the Office for Architectural Culture Practice in London, a man who's designed and built several government buildings across China.
Well, Charles, welcome to the show. And we're obviously here to talk about what's happening in China and this ban on the building of new government and public buildings. Why do you think they've decided to bring this in now?
To me, it's not a big surprise because over the last 10, 15 years, China has been open to the international architectural community, if you like, and lots of foreign architects been designing buildings in China. And at the same time, a local architect try to learn from that. And I think the reasons are, on one hand, the central government probably thought that they're spending too much on such buildings instead of on the infrastructure or the people. And also they tend to oversize the buildings or space they need. So I think that they try to constrain the spending on this.
I mean, a lot of the buildings that have gone up, no one's really heard of. And we've all heard of the Bird's Nest and some of these big landmark towers that have sprung up in Shanghai. But actually there are many more buildings springing up. And some buildings are replicas of European palaces and things like that. I wondered if you've seen any of these buildings and whether they have a kind of purpose or are they more status structures in a way?
Mm. I've seen some of the buildings like that. And unfortunately, from my standpoint, I don't think it's a healthy thing. It's imitation or mimic. And on one hand, there are few good buildings here and there from time to time you see in China. But on the other hand, most of the new buildings are, they try to learn or try to copy what we have in the rest of the world. And without thinking what traditions they have and, you know, the roots
Now, Charles, you've done some work on in mainland China, architectural
yes.
work, and for public institutions as well.
Yes.
That process of, you know, of winning the contract and then dealing with the client, has that been a complicated process? Do you see actually some of the kind of risks involved actually that have led to this kind of ban? Do you find actually sometimes, you know, the client is asking for something that's beyond the scale of what they really need?
Yes, it's been quite complicated, equally if not more than what you would do in similar developing countries. Of course, you know, for public or state buildings or governmental buildings, there are a lot of government involvement. But on the same, in the same time, there as a foreign architect to design a building in China, we need a local associate architect. So, but apart from that, lots of people, specialists like engineers and all the different people are also involved too. So in terms of the professional process, it's not easy. But on the other hand, from, you know, from people like us coming from outside into China, we don't quite know how they work. We know, you know, one or two, but not a whole of it. So the system they are used to work is quite different from what we're familiar with. For example, you know, they have a lot of, you know, socialist, former Soviet influences on top of the complicated Chinese traditional systems. So let alone the corruption and, you know, all these things.
And in terms of design, do you think the government is responding to a lack of thought that's been put into these buildings? I mean, some of the problems have been with corruption, but is this about halting a kind of runaway train of government buildings that don't actually have a real purpose and aren't necessarily designed fit for purpose? Because of that, is it, it's a kind of a vicious circle in a way.
Mm-hmm. On one hand, I think, yes, I think that this policy is positive to stop tendency of making something more than what they need. And also every single local authority tries to show how, you know, how big their vision is and how big their structure is, which it results in such buildings we're seeing now.
And I wanted to ask you, Charles, also, I guess what's interesting is you that it'll be interesting to see how this ban actually works. I guess there's a huge amount of buildings already kind of being built, so there's going to be some time delay as those get finished. And then I guess the other thing is, you know, that there's a good thing about the breathing space as well. We've seen it with the high-speed rail projects as well, which they took a breather in a sense because they knew that actually the pace at which things were being done were leading to kind of shortcuts and dangerous shortcuts. We saw some of the, you know, terrible incidents with the high-speed rail project. Do you think that part of it is also that they're thinking, okay, we need to kind of make sure these buildings are going up in a way that's safe and they're going to last? And also perhaps just kind of outward looking, we've already seen that the current Chinese presidency very keen to kind of say to people, look, you know, we're not profligate. Say, you know, we're not kind of spending loads of money on banquets and things anymore. Do you think part of it is that they just don't want people kind of peering through the windows of City Hall and seeing vast chandeliers and marble floors as well?
I think that's obviously one of the reasons. I think the Chinese government is still trying to find a way out. On one hand, they're being attacked by people, you know, in terms of how they spend money. From my standpoint, I think as a society or a country, I think what's lacking in China is an organic growth. You know, everything is forced, everything is planned. And things like buildings or cities, you know, they're talking about urbanization. You can see everywhere in China, every single street is huge. And the city blocks are huge, therefore buildings are huge, and which in a way kind of encourage people or governments to build something big, which is not the lesson we learned over the last half century, if not more.
Charles Fu there, co-founder of the Office for Architectural Culture Practice in London, talking to Monocle's Andrew Tuck and Sophie Grove.
So in the Northern Hemisphere, summer is upon us and many of us will be packing our bags, not forgetting the bucket and spade, of course, before heading to sunnier climes.
And of course, taking a copy of Monocle's Mediterranean mm-hmm. with us. Now, but if you're a politician, perhaps a break is even more welcome than for the rest of us. All this week on Monocle 24, we'll be looking at the holiday destinations of choice for some of the world's heads of state and finding out why the simple pleasure of going on holiday can in itself be a political minefield.
In the first of our week-long series of presidential postcards, we head to France, where Monocle's man in Paris, Tom Burgess Watson, tells us why President Hollande isn't going anywhere at all for his bon vacances this year.
There is is this culture here in France of really everyone in the month of August goes away somewhere. And this applies to the cabinet ministers. They have a 2-week break from the 2nd of August to the 19th of August, where it is expected that they be away on the beach like everyone else. President Hollande is trying to set an example and send a message at the same time to the French people by actually not going anywhere for his summer holidays. He's entitled to use the presidential retreat in the south of France, which is a great big fort-like structure called Brégançon. But he's chosen not to go there. This is all sort of sending out a message that these are tough times, and he doesn't want the French people to be thinking that whilst they're saving their pennies at home, the French president is living it up on the south coast of France. Neither President Hollande nor his companion have particularly fond memories of their first summer at Brégançon, because she was photographed in her swimming costume and that picture was published all over the world, and she wasn't at all happy about that. And he has likened Brégançon to a prison. And Nicolas Sarkozy didn't really like going there either. So it's been a little underused, and perhaps this idea of not using it to be austere and to save the pennies is going to get people thinking, well, perhaps there's no point in having it, and if we really want to save pennies, perhaps it should be sold off.
The best things in life are free.
They didn't call Nicolas Sarkozy President Bling Bling for nothing here in France. He was often seen on speedboats, on luxury yachts, in different villas. He certainly had a reputation the current president is trying to distance himself from as much as he possibly can. Certainly Sarkozy will go down in modern French history as being the flashiest president this country has known in the Fifth Republic. The other things I should mention as to what might be causing this reluctance to go on holidays. Exactly 10 years ago, France was struck by a massive heat wave, and it killed about 15,000 people, most of them elderly people, who'd been somewhat abandoned, if you like, by their relatives who'd left them in the cities while they'd all gone off on their summer holiday.
On one day alone, a day that's now known as Black Monday, 3,000 Parisians died.
And that sent a terribly shocking message across France that 15,000 elderly had died whilst their children were off enjoying themselves in a heat wave. And with another heat wave like that, precisely 10 years on, perhaps that's got people thinking, let's be a little bit more visible as ministers. Perhaps we should stick around in our constituencies and maybe send out that message we don't want to repeat of 2003.
Chronicle's Paris correspondent Tom Burgess Watson there in the first of our series of presidential postcards. Tomorrow we head to Washington to find out where the Obama family will be sunning themselves this year.
And in the next half hour of the programme, we'll round up the news in Copenhagen for you, and we visit Durban's International Film Festival that was this year dominated by a debate on freedom of speech and censorship.
The people behind the response are showing ignorance, lack of understanding of that which they regulate, and just downright incompetence.
But first, with the time just approaching 33 minutes past the hour, here's James with the headlines.
At least 38 people have been killed when a coach plunged more than 15 metres off a motorway viaduct in southern Italy. Officials say 11 people were pulled out alive from the coach and taken to hospital, some with serious injuries. A series of car bomb attacks in the Iraqi capital Baghdad has killed 44 people. More than 100 people were injured by the blasts in mostly Shia areas of the city, according to police and hospital sources. A requiem mass is due to take place in the Spanish city of Santiago de Compostela today, where a train crash last Wednesday claimed 79 lives. The Spanish Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy, who comes from the city, and members of the Spanish royal family are expected to attend. The European Union's chief foreign policy chief, Catherine Ashton, is to hold crisis talks in Cairo today after the weekend killing of at least 72 supporters of Egypt's deposed Islamist president plunged the country deeper into turmoil. Those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Chloe Potter, and Emma Nelson. Usually the opening night of a film festival is about rolling out that red carpet, checking out who is wearing what among the film stars, and partying all night long. Durban International Film Festival, one of the oldest festivals in South Africa and one of the most important on the African continent, is usually no exception.
But this year, it started off very differently. The opening film, Of Good Report, was initially banned. It was a decision that left filmmakers stunned and angry. The debate that followed about censorship and freedom of expression dominated the entire festival. Léonie March looks back at a very emotional week.
Tonight is the night that we've all been waiting for. But before we begin with the fantastic festivities, we need to pay tribute.
It was a surreal moment. The audience had just honored Nelson Mandela, the lights were dimmed, and everyone was anticipating the world premiere of the South African film noir Of Good Report. But instead, the screen only displayed a short message saying that the Film and Publication Board had refused classification, showing the movie would constitute a criminal offense.
Screen the film!
I have never thought that.
Many in the audience thought it was a joke at first, but it wasn't. When the lights came on a few minutes later, the director of the film, Jamilix Dikubeka, had taped his mouth shut in protest. His movie tells the unsettling story of a teacher with a penchant for young girls, told from the perspective of this increasingly obsessive sexual predator. The controversy arose from an oral sex scene near the beginning of the film. For the state regulators, it contravened the law by depicting a minor engaging in a sexual act. In a first reaction, Kubeka shook his head in disbelief.
In a country with alarming statistics of kids getting pregnant at school level from their own teachers, it's a kick in the teeth because the people behind the response are showing ignorance, lack of understanding of that which they regulate, and just downright incompetence.
Most filmmakers at the festival were speaking of censorship. It was the first film to be effectively banned in South Africa since 1994, the year of the first democratic elections. Outraged, the producers immediately lodged an appeal. A week of heated discussions later, just hours before the festival's closing night, the appeal tribunal lifted the ban.
Of Good Report is assigned a classification of 16 with the advisories violence, nudity and sex.
The decision was celebrated as a victory for artistic freedom. The manager of Durban's International Film Festival, Peter Machen, acknowledged the film's achievements in stimulating an important debate, highlighting crucial issues in South African society.
Basically, the people become scared of becoming censored. There's rising conservatism. It's increasingly difficult to get art funding. Apartheid justified itself by being a Christian nationalism. And, you know, the current situation in many, many ways echoes exactly the same kind of things that were happening in the late 80s in South Africa when I was a kind of an adolescent. Reality was filtered. Reality was controlled. You couldn't be yourself. And I just don't want to go back there. I never want to go back there.
You want to fight?
What does it mean to be a criminal in this society?
Peter Machen has made a point in selecting brave and critical films for this year's festival. Traditionally, there's a strong focus on African contemporary cinema, an array of aesthetically very diverse feature films, shorts and documentaries. But there seems to be one common trend.
This is something that has to stop.
I think nearly all of the films, including A Good Report, were films that are about the future. So we're still dealing with, you know, like hardcore topics like forced marriage of children, tribalism, violence. But there's an incredible energy in many of these films, and they really are. They're moving toward the future. And really, I think a lot of these films are not just reflecting and echoing reality, but they are trying to change reality. And I think that is actually the key thing that I saw this year.
One of these films comes from Kenya. It's Us, Nisisi portrays a typical community whose foundation is shaken by spreading rumors dividing ethnic groups, leading to fear and violence, just as it was the case in Kenya during the post-election violence in 2008. It's a parable with a strong educational morale focusing on hope and the power of change. Co-producer Christine Savan.
We're talking about how politicians are using people in terms of trying to get them, dividing people. Tribalism, incitement, corruption, using rumors. So it goes on and on, being distorted. And that's the thing, that people should say no to rumors. People should say no to tribalism. People should know that the power of change is in their hands. It's just them. If someone comes and tells you a rumor, you need to find out what's the source of that rumor. Is it true or not?
Uninformed judgments and preconceptions are also challenged in the documentary Two Men and a Wedding. It's part of a festival focused on sexual identities. South African director Sarah Bletcher tells the story of a gay couple in Malawi who were sentenced to 14 years imprisonment and only pardoned after international pressure.
When you go into the details of a story like that, you start realizing that the headlines that say, oh, Africa's homophobic, are actually, they're not the story. The story is very, very, very layered and complex, like in the case of Stephen and Tiwonge. I mean, Tiwonge grew up in a village, a rural village, and he literally considers himself a woman. And he was absolutely accepted in this village. Then he decided to have the wedding ceremony, and that was absolutely fine until somebody said, oh my God, he's a man. And then it became a big political issue. I mean, the president literally used it to deflect attention from his lack of governance.
Two Men and a Wedding is an insightful investigation, which can also be seen as a comment to the international debate around gay marriage and to some of the Africa clichés abroad. The festival in Durban has shown that African filmmakers are starting to trust their own perspectives and voices, raising them to change perceptions and challenge their realities, defending freedom of expression. For Monocle in Durban, South Africa, I'm Leonie March.
And you can hear more treats from this week's edition of Culture at 2100 hours in Istanbul, 1900 hours here if you're listening in London, and 1400 hours in New York.
You're listening to Midori House. We'll be back in a moment to round up the day's news in Denmark with our correspondent Michael Booth in Copenhagen.
Each Sunday on Monocle 24, we like to take stock.
The wonder of history for the journalist is you can delve into this immense booty of information.
I don't even know what to think about that.
Take the global pulse.
I was at a bunga bunga party the other day.
And?
But I wasn't at all. I just wanted to start a show like that. We're 187 shows down. How's your week been?
I'm feeling 187, actually.
And occasionally take things down a notch, too.
I had a pair of plum suede loafers with gold snaffles. And a guy stopped his car and leant out of the window and said it was people like me who were bringing this country to its knees.
To end the week with the best chat.
We know that he had them and we know that he used them before.
Because we still had the receipts.
Well, there's that.
Some great music.
Do you know, I never thought that I might need to have a question about death metal, but I'm warming up.
And some good fun to set up Sunday and warm the week ahead. The Monocle Weekly. Your week starts here.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Chloe Potter, and Emma Nelson. The time is 8:42 here in London, 9:42 in Copenhagen, where we head next for a roundup of the day's news with our correspondent there, Michael Booth. Welcome to the show, Michael.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Good, thank you. How are you?
Excellent.
Things
excellent.
Finally looking up for the Danish economy.
Well, I'm not sure if they are. The story is that the Danes have just started spending money again. Consumer confidence has skyrocketed in June and July, up something like 10%. And I wonder if the Danes have just simply got bored with prudence and they've decided just to go spending. They've got bored with this recession, which has been dragging on, to be fair. But they've been splurging on new cars and home extensions, buildings, and unemployment is down. There's still low inflation, low interest rates, so perhaps there is some foundation to be positive, but it's maybe too early to say yet, but the talk right now is that the Danes are ready to get out of this recession.
It has come with mixed messages, hasn't it? Because as you say, people are now spending, but Danske Bank have said that the Danish economy is moving sideways and this little jump in GDP is only temporary.
Yeah, but I mean, productivity, which has been the big problem for the Danes in the last 10 years, does seem to be showing some signs of finally growing, rather not declining at the pace it has been declining. So again, I mean, it's, and then there's also the problem of the Danes' huge private debt burden. They're the most indebted people in Europe, if not the world, personally. Their government's okay, their government economy is okay, but privately the Danes love to borrow. And perhaps my concern is, I'm not an economist, but my concern is the Danes are just going on another one of their borrowing sprees because they all fancy a new Audi.
The Danes have, I think they obviously recognise this because they would like to spend a bigger proportion of the budget on fiscal stimulus. In fact, I think a report that the Danish government issued last week was they wanted Europe to relax budget restrictions so that they could, in fact, spend more. Do you think, given what you've just told us, Europe will listen to that?
Well, I don't know about whether Europe will allow them, but it's a very unusual situation in Denmark right now in that we have a red bloc government, a left-leaning government, which has been forced to implement massive spending cuts and try and actually reduce taxes. But on the other hand, they've been kind of by the back door trying to stimulate the economy in a good old social democratic fashion by spending on major infrastructure projects. So they're about to start building a bridge to Germany, and it's a bridge I'm not sure anyone really needs, but it's obviously going to cost an awful lot of money and pump a lot more money back into the economy. So that kind of spending, you see it all around in Denmark, new roads being built and bypasses and bridges and all this kind of stuff. So I'm not sure if Denmark really cares what Europe says about their spending. You know, this is all political. There's an election coming up in about 2 years' time. The Social Democratic Party, who's in the government at the moment, are way, way down in the polls. And I think they see they've got a couple of years to turn things around. So I'm sure they'll be extremely happy that these new economic signals are positive.
And Michael, moving on to a different matter, there's been some controversial coverage of Lithuanian and Romanian gangs in the country.
Yeah, there's been some interesting coverage in the media this weekend, actually. An interview with a Romanian burglar from his prison cell in Denmark, giving an interesting perspective on why there appear to be a lot of Romanians and Lithuanians in Denmark at the moment and in Danish prisons. I think something like 10% of prisoners in Danish prisons are from Eastern European countries. And it seems that, number one, there are simple, easy pickings for thieves in Denmark. The Danes are a trusting bunch, basically. And number two, Danish prisons are pretty nice. The Romanian prisoner who was interviewed described how they can earn 600 kroner a week and they only have to share a cell with one other person. It's pretty easygoing, television and so on. And there is a concern that this is encouraging increasing criminality in Denmark. And apparently the country has been divided. The eastern side is taken over by Lithuanian mafia, the western side by Romanian mafia. So the Danes are slightly unhappy that their country is being divided up in this way, and in a sense taken advantage of.
Finally, Michael, let's move on to a spectacular cultural event held in possibly the only place that you could hold a theatre festival.
Yeah, well, it's the annual Shakespeare Festival at Elsinore or Helsinger Castle in northern Zealand, and for maybe 30, 40 years now, every year, they've been staging a production of Hamlet, and they've had people like Laurence Olivier come and give his Hamlet. Michael Caine, I think, played Laertes back in the 60s. It's quite astonishing to imagine Michael Caine in Shakespeare, but he's been here. Kenneth Branagh, of course. And now the new Shakespeare Festival is launching on Thursday with 3 days of, I think that's going to be King Lear, and a screening of Branagh's Hamlet as well.
And any big stars this year?
No, not this year. It's been a while since there have been some major stars, actually. I'm not sure if it's gone a little bit off the radar.
Oh, well, Michael Booth, I'm sure it will be fantastic anyway. Thanks for joining us from Copenhagen. We'll be having a look at what's making headlines in the Brazilian press in just a moment. But to take us there, this is Gilberto Gil with Aquele Abraço.
Este samba vai para Dorival Caymmi, João Gilberto e Caetano Veloso. Vamos lá. O Rio de Janeiro continua lindo. O Rio de de Janeiro continua sendo. O Rio de Janeiro, fevereiro e março. Alô, alô, Realengo, aquele abraço. Alô, torcida do Flamengo, aquele abraço. Alô, alô, Realengo, aquele abraço. Alô, torcida do Flamengo, aquele abraço. Olha o breque. Chacrinha continua balançando a pança e buzinando a moça e comandando a massa. E continua dando as ordens no terreiro. Alô, alô, seu Chacrinha, velho guerreiro. Alô, alô, Terezinha, Rio de Janeiro. Alô, alô, seu Chacrinha, velho palhaço. Alô, alô, Terezinha, aquele abraço. Alô, moça da favela, aquele abraço. Todo mundo da Portela, aquele abraço. Todo mês de fevereiro, aquele passo. Alô, banda de Ipanema, aquele abraço. Meu caminho pelo mundo eu mesmo traço. A Bahia já me deu. Sendo o Rio de Janeiro, fevereiro e março. Alô, alô, Realengo! Alô, torcida do Flamengo! Alô, alô, Realengo! Alô, torcida do Flamengo! Aquele abraço! Olha o breque! Chacrinha continua balançando a pança e buzinando a moça e comandando a massa. E continua dando as ordens no terreiro. Alô, alô, seu Chacrinha, velho guerreiro. Alô, alô, Terezinha. Alô, alô, seu Chacrinha. Alô, alô, Terezinha, aquele abraço. Alô, moça da favela, aquele abraço. Todo mundo da Portela, aquele abraço. Todo mês de fevereiro, aquele passo.
That was Gilberto Gil with Aquele Abraço. And joining us now to leaf through the Brazilian front pages is our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Good morning, Fernando.
Good morning.
Looking
how are you?
Resplendent.
As always.
In sort of candy pink.
You know, I'm very happy. You know why, right?
I know why. We'll get to that in a minute. The music, that wonderful song, was a little bit of a clue in just a few moments' time. But first, we have happiness of a massive kind on the beach of Copacabana. We've had an awful lot of coverage of the Pope's visit to Brazil and how it has polarised the community and people are no longer wanting to be Catholic, and how some television channels haven't touched the Pope's visit and this, that, and the other, and everyone thought it was terrible.
It doesn't look that way.
Doesn't look that way, does it?
Well, just look at the picture on the cover of Folha de São Paulo. Basically, 3 million people in Copacabana Beach. That's more than the New Year's party, which is already huge.
I wonder, though, if he'd gone to a really dowdy shopping centre, would 3 million have turned up?
Are you suggesting, Emma, they would have gone to the beach anyway?
Well, first of all, there wouldn't be space, you know. Actually, funnily enough, this last mass, it was supposed to be in another place. It was supposed to be in Guaratiba. But then because for safety reasons, they decided to move to Copacabana because there's more space, you know, and everything.
Because so many people.
Exactly. Wow. 3 million people. And actually,
they were right to do that.
It's an interesting note. Rio became the Brazilian city with the highest number of tourists in a week ever.
Goodness.
So that's a record. But funnily enough, there's another story on Folha de São Paulo saying that the occupancy rate of hotels was just 62%. Because I think the visitors, they were kind of in this austerity mood as well, like the Pope likes to preach.
Did it also have to do with the fact that they had World Youth Day which is a Catholic thing. When I was in Paris, I saw what we actually called Catho Pride, because you, because you ended up with literally thousands of hormonal Catholic teenagers all placed together in a hot place. I mean, frankly, the city turned a rather pink, sort of slightly sort of frustrated shade for about 3 or 4 days. And you can always imagine that children younger people don't necessarily want to go into hotels. They will find cheaper ways and means to enjoy their exactly. holidays. So I wonder, perhaps that's the reason why the hotels weren't so full, or maybe people were just sleeping on the beach.
A lot of families actually were welcoming people in their houses. I heard a story of a family that don't speak any Portuguese at all, you know, and the tourists as well, they didn't speak English. So basically, you know, but they managed to talk in body contact. Like, Emma, you've met my mother, for example, right?
I have met Mrs. Fernando. She's brilliant.
Her English is not great, but you end up becoming best friends.
Well, she ended up coming and spending quite a lot of time in my living room, and I have not a clue what the lovely lady said, but she was most welcome.
That's the beautiful thing about the world, no?
But I wonder, is that Brazilian or is that Mrs. Fay? What I do want to know, though, is what was the Pope's reaction to this? Because obviously he's gone to Brazil to try to garner more support for Catholicism. This, you know, this is obviously why the Vatican chose a South American Pope. Do you think that he was actually surprised by this reaction?
I think he was surprised, and I think in the end it worked, because the Catholic Church has reasons to worry, because they are losing faithfuls in Brazil, you know, because of the evangelical churches. And in fact, Rio is the state with the least number of Catholics in Brazil. So, and I think it works, you know, because it's very charismatic, especially comparing to the other Pope. I mean, he was okay as well, but he was not charismatic at all, you know, I have to say.
And this provides a lovely forum for him to show that off. A great speech.
Exactly. And he said as well, interesting thing, I don't like those who don't protest. Young people don't conform, and that's very beautiful.
Which is wonderful.
It's a wonderful note. Of course, it's a bit contradictory when you see what the church preaches, but it's a very interesting speech.
What's he saying in O Globo here?
Oh, that basically he's talking about the protests, what I just said. Actually, he's kind of supporting the protests. And that's a very interesting note.
Let's move on to something that's of a different nature, but still youth connected. The fall of MTV Brazil, once the great sort of pillar of youth television.
Exactly. In the 90s, I remember when I was a child, I used to watch MTV Brazil all the time. It was very, MTV Brazil was not just a copy of the US MTV. It had like a Brazilian vibe. Even I remember in the summer months, they used to move the whole schedule of the channel. They went to the beach. They had a beach house. And it was such a lovely channel. But now, because of the internet, young people are not watching video clips on TV anymore. Now it's going to become a small kind of pay TV channel from October. And there'll be no video clips anymore. That's very weird.
Maybe it's just you and possibly Emma and I who are nostalgic for that. You know, it's different these days, isn't it? Young people don't watch television full stop.
Perhaps not. I mean, I always wonder what the degree of cultural inclusion that children can now have, given the fact that everything is compartmentalised into, you know, you will watch this on the internet, that on TV. It is sad to see that MTV is going, but it does seem like something that belongs to the past.
Exactly.
Something, however, that does is well, that's an uncomfortable segue. You had something very exciting happen to you this weekend,
well,
didn't you?
Very exciting. Well, basically, I met one of my idols on Saturday. I met Gilberto Gil. He had an amazing song, Aquele Abraço, that we just listened here. And he was headlining the WOMAD Festival in Woodshire. And I just took a train and interviewed him for the Culture Show, which is going to be played next week. And it was fascinating to interview him. I was even a bit nervous. Usually I don't get nervous when I do interviews, I have to say. But with Gilberto, I was a little bit.
And he's a gentleman in his 70s, but you say he's super smart.
Well, super smart and very elegant. He was sitting down in a chair. He's kind of very slim. And, well, it was. And when I did interview him, he was looking in my eyes, you know. He had a very kind of nice aura about that. He had this kind of Nelson Mandela aura somehow. That's, you know, I love him, and I was very excited.
And Mrs. Fay, your mother?
Well, I took a picture, of course, and I sent it to her. I mean, I was like, Gilberto, sorry, can I take a picture? I know, I felt like a little child when I was close to him, but it was a nice, very nice weekend.
How
after meeting Gilberto.
Fernanda Augusta Pacheco, typically excited. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you very much. That's all we have time for today. Thanks to our producer, Marcus Hippy, our researchers, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Elena Falco. Our studio manager was Toby Hammond. And up next, after the news, is the latest edition of The Urbanist with Monocle's editor, Andrew Tuck. And then The Briefing is on at midday, hosted by Robert Bound.
But for now, from me, Emma Nelson,
And me, Chloe Potter, thanks very much for listening.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.